Welcome to the Powell House Press. Today's podcast continues Joshua Powell's memoir, Father and Son. If you like this podcast, look for Josh on Medium and Substack. His handle is jdpowell65. Now, Chapter 4 from Father and Son.
There is a place where the bad memories are filed away. I see them like photos in a family album, smiling by the Christmas tree, wearing costumes for Halloween, birthday parties, and trips. But there was more to it than pictures glued to black construction paper bound in leather. There were other pictures. That was where the monster lived. That's where I keep Dad now, hidden deep in the dark parts of my memory, in the past. Little League 1975. Mom and Dad gave me a bat, ball, and mitt on my 7th birthday. I had never played baseball, watched ball games on TV, or expressed any interest in sports. Thus, my birthday present seemed random and foreign, like no gift at all. "Your father said you'd love this," Mom said, sensing I did not want it. The message was clear. I am not the boy my dad wants me to be. I knew he was unhappy when I wanted to play with my big gym doll and his camper, a more masculine toy than Barbie, but not by much, and still a doll. I felt I had no choice but to say I loved the bat, ball, and mitt. Dad had been in a horrible car accident and had just gotten out of the hospital after 3 months. Mom said a deer had jumped out of the woods and ran into the road. That's what caused the crash. He was lucky to be alive, she said. It was a lie, but at the time, I believed her. This was my birthday, right before my brother Seth was born. I remember wanting a little brother so he could do things with Dad that I didn't want to. But when Seth was born on July 31, 1972, he was not the little brother I wanted. Seth always cried, and when he wasn't crying, he slept. He was just a baby, not a brother at all. The bat, ball, and mitt remained unused that summer, fall, and winter. By spring, my father could walk again, stand, and paint, but we never played ball, and that was fine with me. It was a Saturday morning in late spring. I was sitting at the breakfast table, eating my favorite breakfast, frosted flakes with slices of bananas. Dad walked into the room and announced that we'd be starting Little League. "I thought we'd go down to the baseball field," he said. He must have seen my look of pure anxiety. "You'll be great," he said. "I don't want to," I said as the panic set in. "Josh," my mother started, "Eddie will be there. So will Mark and Jack. You will have a good time. Just try it." Eddie Stoner was my best friend, whom my father always called Fast Eddie. The Stoners lived down the street in a large house with a wraparound porch. When I wandered up to the side door, Mrs. Stoner always seemed to be in the kitchen. I would ask if Eddie could come out and ride bikes. She'd call Eddie, and as I waited for him, she'd wrap a snack in a napkin for us. Mark Temple lived on the other side of the village. He was a year older than me. I thought Mr. and Mrs. Temple were the best-looking couple in the world. They were young and active. They played tennis and other sports. Mrs. Temple jumped rope every day when she got home from teaching school. When I'd show up at their back door looking for Mark, she screamed for him but kept jumping rope in the kitchen. I'd never seen anyone jump rope that fast. Mark's dad was one of the Little League coaches, which made me feel a little better as Dad and I walked down to the field. I didn't know why my mother mentioned Jack. I hated him. The Hopfensbergers lived in a large house across the street. They were rich. I knew this because Kristen Hopfensberger, who was my age and one of 8 kids, told me so. Mr. Hopfensberger was Dad's best friend. Mom said Dad was Mr. Hopfensberger's only friend. When Dad and I got to the baseball diamond, all the other boys were wearing baseball uniforms, but not me. Dad sat on the bleachers while I joined the boys from the village and outlying areas. Mr. Temple told us to pick up our mitts. "Josh, you go to deep center field," Mr. Temple said encouragingly. "Where's that?" I asked, and the boys laughed at me. I felt my face get red. "You see that base at the top of the field across from home plate?" I nodded. "Go past that until you're almost in the tall grass, okay?" I nodded. "Good. Now get out there, Southpaw." "Southpaw?" I thought it was a good nickname as I ran into the baseball diamond with the other boys. I put on my glove, and Mom, knowing I was right-handed, assumed I should have a glove that fit my right hand. Mr. Temple started hitting balls to all of us boys from home plate. Some were grounders, others were pops. I got a pop. The ball landed in my glove with such force that I almost fell. The pain shot into my palm, down my arm, and into my entire being with such intensity that my eyes started to water. I wanted to cry, but I knew I couldn't. The ball immediately fell out of my glove and onto the ground. Mr. Temple yelled at me to throw the ball home. The other kids yelled at me to pick up the ball and throw it. I picked up the ball with my left hand and cocked my arm back. With all the power I could muster, I hurled the ball about a yard, which went straight into the ground. All the boys laughed. I didn't know throwing a ball with your left arm when you were a righty would never work. "Wait a minute," Mr. Temple yelled across the field. "Are you left-handed, son?" "No." "Then why the hell are you wearing a lefty's glove?" he asked, and I shrugged. When we were called in from the field, I felt relief. Dad said nothing. "Okay, boys, I want you all to go and pick a bat and see which one feels right for you." I saw an aluminum bat and picked it up. "Does that bat feel right for you, Josh?" I had no idea what the right feeling was. The only thing that I knew was that I liked it more than the wood ones. "Yeah, I like it, Mr. Temple," I said. Mr. Temple walked over to me, put his hand on my shoulder, and bent down to my level to look me in the eye. "Josh, when we're playing ball, you call me Coach Temple. You got that?" "Yeah," I said, embarrassed. "Yeah, what?" Mr. Temple asked. "Yeah, coach," I said, looking up at my dad. I felt like I was dropped into a different world. Boy after boy went to home base and tapped their bat on the plate. Almost all of them hit the ball. Some soared into the sky, and others rolled fast along the ground. Jack hit it so hard and straight that it almost took the pitcher's head off. "Jack, knock it off," Coach Temple said, squatting behind the catcher. When it was my turn, I walked up to the plate like the other boys, tapped my bat on the plate, and tried my best to stand up straight and keep my eye on the ball. The boys, even Mark and Eddie, started this chant out of nowhere. "He's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter." Then when the ball came towards the plate, they screamed, "Swing," and I did. I swung at the ball so hard that I twirled in a full circle and staggered to a stop. All the boys laughed, and once again I felt my face burn. "It's okay, Josh," Coach Temple said. "You can do this." Again the chant, "He's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter, swing." Again I spun around like a top. The kids laughed, and I felt my eyes swell with tears. I hated this. "Just keep your eyes on the ball, Josh," Coach Temple said reassuringly. "He's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter, he's a no-hitter, swing." I closed my eyes and chopped the bat through the air with all my might, and four things happened. 1. The ball and bat connected and made a resonating, hollow, metallic sound. 2. I immediately dropped the bat because of the radiating pain that left my hands on fire. 3. I howled in pain. 4. Jack caught the ball effortlessly. "You're out, you girl," Jack barked, and all the other boys laughed, including Eddie and Mark. "Knock it off, Jack, or I'll send you home and call your father," Coach Temple said in front of all the boys. Jack nodded, but I saw the smirk on his face, and I knew Coach Temple's scolding meant nothing to him. Before I was sent back to the scene, outfield, Coach Temple dug into a large, white canvas duffel bag and gave me another mitt. "Use this one. Catch with your left hand and throw with your right. Now get out there." I could hear the kids chanting their "he's a no-hitter" taunt, which sounded less menacing than when I was at the plate. The most action I saw were the bees hopping from one waist-high wildflower to another. Jack was standing at the plate. "Coming at you, Powell," he said, pointing the bat towards me. Of course, he hit the ball so hard that it sounded like a snapping chicken bone, only louder. Coach Temple yelled for me to look alive, and then the moment's horror unfolded in slow motion. The ball rose in the sky beyond the treetops, higher than anything except the sun. The ball seemed to hang there for a while, as if it was picking out who would catch it. I heard a bunch of the boys near me yelling out that they got it, but as the ball started its rocket-like descent, it was clear it was coming straight at me. Like a meteor, the ball moved past the infielders and towards me. Faster and faster, it sliced through the air. I swear I could hear it roar like a missile. I held my left hand as a shield, closed my eyes, and ducked. I saw the ball about 5 feet away when I opened my eyes. I went for it, but before I could get there, another boy grabbed it, and I heard him say, "Spaz." I looked up and saw my father in the bleachers. I could feel his disappointment. On the way home, He said we'd practice. I'm not coming back, I said. Yes, you are, he said as we walked home. When we got home, he told me to follow him. We walked into the backyard, next to the converted barn that was his art studio. Okay, go out by the back towards the barn. Take your bat, and I'll throw you some balls, he said as he tossed the ball between his left and right hand. I'm not playing. I hate it. The boys are all mean, and I can't do it, I said, raising my voice and coming closer to tears. Take the bat and get out there, he ordered. No, I said, taking an unheard-of stance. He grabbed me by my shoulders and shook me hard. You get out there with the bat, or God help me, I'll cuff you. Do you understand me? Yes, I said, walking out to the back of the lawn. I had no idea what being cuffed meant, but I knew I didn't want to find out. I missed most of the first ones he tossed toward me, but then I started to hit a few, then more and more. See, isn't this fun? He asked. Yeah, I guess, but I wasn't being honest. I hated baseball. I think you are going to be a slugger, he said, smiling at me. After brushing my teeth that night, I went into the kitchen and said goodnight to Mom. She kissed me and told me to say goodnight to my father, who was in the living room. Goodnight, Dad, I said, standing in the doorway between the living room and the foyer. Come give me a kiss, he said. I walked over to him and kissed his cheek. I don't know why I asked the question, but I did. Dad, what does cuff mean? I asked, standing in my pajamas beside the wing chair where he was reading a book. He looked at me, and then, out of nowhere, he walloped me on the side of my head. I was too stunned to cry. I just walked away and went upstairs with a metal taste in my mouth and my left ear ringing. Martha's Vineyard, 1974. I had to go to bed early because we were going to Martha's Vineyard early the following day and had to drive 4 hours to catch the first ferry. While complaining about having to go to bed early, I was excited to see the ocean for the first time. On July 4th, a few weeks before, I turned 8. Many of my presents were beach toys, such as sand molds and shovels. I got a kite that Dad said would be perfect for the beach because the wind would be steady and strong enough to carry it super high. My father woke me up that morning. It was still dark, and he yanked me out of bed, grabbing my hair. What did you do? He bellowed at me. I had no idea what he was talking about. What? I said, shaking in fear. You know what? He told me. Then he grabbed my left arm and beat me with a wooden spoon he held in his right hand, hitting my butt and the back of my thighs in a barrage of swats that burned like lava. After what seemed like an eternity of him beating me, he grabbed me again by the hair and dragged me out of my room and down the hall into Leah's room. Next to her bed, the wallpaper had been chipped at, exposing a large part of the wall. Your sister told me it was you, he said with a menacing tone. Before I could get the word out, he dragged me back to my room and started to beat me again. Then he stopped. Tell the truth, or God help you. My father woke me up that morning. It was still dark, and he yanked me out of bed, grabbing my hair. It wasn't me, I whispered, still crying. Then he walloped me on the side of my head, so hard I fell to the floor. I curled into a ball and held my arms protectively around my head. You know what, Joshua? You're not coming to Martha's Vineyard. You can stay at your grandmother's, he said, leaving my room. I was crying in my bed, listening to everyone eat breakfast and talk, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. After what seemed like an eternity, my mother came into my room. Get up and get dressed. Then we can drop you at Granny's while the rest of us will go to the ocean. I am so disappointed in you. You don't deserve a vacation, she said. I wanted to tell her I didn't even go into Leah's room last night, but was too scared to tell the truth. We all got in the Buick estate wagon, and Mom and Dad sat up front. Mom held Seth on her lap. Lucy sat behind Dad, and I sat behind Mom. Leah was in the middle. We're dropping your brother off at Granny's, my mother said. He's not coming with us because of what he did to Leah's room. I hope we don't miss the ferry, my father said, cranking his neck back to glare at me. Because if we do, you will be a very sorry young man. I started to cry then, humiliated and scared. Maybe we should just take him, my mother said. I don't know, Dorothy. He's been so bad. I know, Dunning, but we don't want to miss the ferry, my mother said. You better be on your best behavior, my father said. I was still crying. Stop your crying right now. You're lucky to be included. He looked back at the road, then back at me again. I was still crying, not making noise. Still, my eyes were streaming with tears, and every so often I'd breathe in, and my inhale had an audible staccato to it. "I mean it. Stop it, or I'll give you something to cry about." I looked down and wiped my tears away. I was too embarrassed to look anywhere, afraid I'd meet someone else's gaze in the car. When I stopped crying, I looked across the bench seat. Lucy was reading Jaws, and somehow, she found out the movie would be filmed on the island that summer. When Leah and I made eye contact, she looked down into her hands. She couldn't look me in the eye, and that's when I knew she had peeled off the wallpaper and lied about it. She said it was me. I turned and looked out the window. I had a massive lump in my throat, and soon I fell asleep, exhausted by the day's events. It wasn't even 8 a.m. We sat in plastic chairs around a table bolted to the deck. My mother declared that we were officially on vacation, and she wanted to put the morning behind all of us, even me. Sitting next to me, my father reached out to rough up my hair, an overt show of forgiveness. I flinched. "Can I go out on the deck?" I asked, wanting nothing more than to be away from my family. "Sure, Lucy, go with your brother," my mother said. "Okay, let's go," Lucy said. "Be careful," my father said. Gone was the rage and the scary voice. It was emotional whiplash. Lucy and I were standing at the railing on the deck, looking out. "It was Leah, wasn't it?" Lucy asked. "I think so, but it wasn't me," I said, starting to cry. "Don't cry, it's over," she said, taking my hand. When we got the car off the ferry and drove to the house we rented, things were getting back to normal, but I was secretly hoping Leah would tell Mom and Dad the truth. By bedtime, she still hadn't, so I fell asleep, trying to make sense of the whole day. Josh, wake up, honey. It was my father. It was dark outside, and the ocean air was cold. I did not know what to do. My heart was pounding. "It's okay. It's okay. I wanted to say I am so sorry about this morning," he said. I didn't know what to say. I just kept still. Then he laid down next to me and told me he knew it was not me. He didn't tell me if Leah confessed, but I had a feeling that Lucy told him about our talk on the deck. I didn't care. I lay in bed and eventually fell asleep. When I woke up again, it was still dark, and my father was sleeping next to me. I got out of bed and tiptoed to the chair in the corner. I sat down and looked at him in the darkness, trying to understand why he didn't like me. I stayed in the chair for the rest of the night. When I first flew the kite, it was not on the beach. Still, the island winds were strong enough to take the kite high into the sky, so high that I ran out of string. Dad got another spool of twine and tied the end of the string to the start of the new one. After that, the kite got higher and higher. When I looked back to see who was watching, I saw my father had set up his easel and painted me flying the kite. The kite was so high that it became a red dot in the blue, cloudless sky. "Dinner, Josh, Dunning, dinner's ready," my mother yelled from the house's back deck. I tried desperately to rewind the string on the spool, but it was clear to my father I couldn't. Then, finally, he came over and tried to himself. "I don't think this is going to happen before dinner," he said. "Why don't we tie it up?" He walked over to the huge dead tree lying on the ground and tied it to a branch. "Do you think it will hold?" I asked. "Yeah, I do," he said, and we walked towards the house. He rubbed my head, and this time, I didn't flinch. Summer Olympics. July 1976. We moved to the house on Dorland Road because Dad was getting busier with portrait commissions. After he was picked to paint Governor Malcolm Wilson's portrait, his career started to take off. He even got a pilot show on PBS teaching people how to paint. The barn across the dirt road from the house had a huge studio upstairs where my dad built a stage for his clients to sit when he was painting them. The studio's ceilings followed the exterior roofline, and one side had three single panes of glass from the eaves to the apex. They must have been at least 25 feet long. The house was one of only three on the road. It was deep in the middle of 70 acres of woods. The best part for me was the large pond down the hill from the house. There was a sandy beach, not big, but big enough to have a few lawn chaises. On one side, there was a weeping willow tree. The square dock that floated in the middle of the pond, which you had to swim out to, was faded gray, but it was sturdy. Dad had two brothers with whom he had recently reconnected. While I knew his brother, Uncle Ted, I met his other brother, Uncle Bob, when I was 5. That was the summer he dropped off his 2 daughters, my cousins Tessa and Katie, to stay with us in the country. My Aunt Jean, a woman I never met, had died from breast cancer. My uncle was overwhelmed with his 6 children. He was a sports columnist for the Buffalo News and the traveling reporter covering the Buffalo Braves. He was always on the road. He needed mom and dad to help with some of his kids. Even after that summer, I saw Uncle Bob rarely. This summer was different. Uncle Bob was coming to visit with his new wife, Terry, and his 2 stepkids, Katie and John. It was fun having a new family. The year before, I met Dad's father, my grandfather. Dad never told us why he didn't see his brothers or father, and when we kids asked, my mother would tell us to shush. Still, I had not met my other brother, my father's first son, Walter Dunning Powell IV, known as Young Dunny. He was like a legend, a folk tale. "Someday you'll meet him," my mother would tell me. Dad never talked about Dunny. That day, Mom and Aunt Terry walked us down to the pond for a swim. Lucy was in the studio with Dad and Uncle Bob, so it was just Leah, John, Katie, Seth, and me. John and I carried a large cooler filled with ice, soda, snacks, and a Tupperware pitcher filled with Bloody Marys for Mom and Aunt Terry. It was so hot that day. We stayed in the water for hours while Mom and Terry sat in chaise lawn chairs. Terry was slathered in zinc oxide while Mom was covered in Bain de Soleil, making her look orange. Eventually, as the sun fell in the late afternoon, we packed the cooler, towels, toys, and trash. As I walked up the hill to the house, I saw Dad and Uncle Bob standing around the barbecue. I could smell the lighter fluid and see the orange flames whip as they started the grill. Uncle Bob had a beer in his hand, and Dad had a whiskey sour. When we reached them, they were in a great mood. I looked at the fire, and Dad put his hand on the back of my neck. "Wow, you smell like the pond. Why don't you go upstairs and shower?" he said, then looked at all the kids. "All of you." We sat down to dinner on the patio, where citronella candles burned in colored glass containers with white plastic netting. We had steaks, blistered hot dogs, and hamburgers. Mom made Granny's famous potato salad. For dessert, we had frozen pops and Aunt Terry's ambrosia, which I had never had before. Before Uncle Bob and his family visited, Dad and I had been watching the Montreal Olympics every night. Dad liked football. He played at the University of Michigan before WW2. While I had no interest in football, I loved the Olympics, and so did he. He'd even let me stay up late to watch them. But that night, he didn't watch the Olympics. Instead, he stayed with his brother, Mom, and Aunt Terry on the patio. My cousin John loved the Olympics too, and the two of us stuffed ourselves in the oversized white chair that we called the TV chair and waited to see the other John Powell, the one on the USA track team, toss the discus. "Here he comes." John screamed with excitement. When no one paid attention to him, he shouted it again. My father came into the room from the patio. "What's going on?" he asked, lumbering into the room. "Look," John said excitedly, "it's me." Then he leaped out of the chair and swirled in front of the TV as if he were the Olympian, and then he tossed the discus that only existed in his 10-year-old mind. It tickled my father, and he walked over to John and tussled his hair. "Okay, boys, after this, go upstairs and get ready for bed," he said. "Dunning," my mother called from the kitchen, "it's getting too buggy outside. We're coming inside. Do you want me to make you another drink?" she asked. It was still light out, but it was dimmer. The woods surrounding our old farmhouse started to dance with fireflies and the sounds of crickets. Upstairs, John and I changed into our pajamas and went back downstairs to ask if we could stay up later and watch more of the Olympics. "No, it's time for bed," my Aunt Terry ruled, and all the adults concurred. "Come on, Mom," John begged. "Up to bed," my father said, and John and I reluctantly slunk upstairs and crawled into my twin bed. Downstairs, we could hear our parents becoming louder, their words getting sloppy. I could hear moving chairs and ice cubes hitting the sides of cocktail glasses. Darkness came as they had one drink after another. John and I both couldn't sleep. We were getting silly and started a tickle fight. "Stop," I said, and began my tickle assault on him. We were mainly giggling, but occasionally a yelp would slip out. My father appeared in my room like an apparition. He leaned over the bed, his breath having the woody smell of whiskey, and his eyes were glassy. "Didn't I tell you to get to bed?" he asked with his sloppy, drunken words. John separated us, but he was no real barrier. I knew this man. My other father, the menacing, violent man. Before I could mutter an answer, he slapped me hard across the face. "Didn't I tell you to go to sleep?" And again, before I could answer, another slap, and again, tears were running down my face, but I did not make a sound. I was like a fawn lying still in deep grass, paralyzed with fear and hope. No reaction would be the strategy that might keep it alive. Next to me, John was trembling with fear. And then, all at once, my father left the room. "Josh," John whispered, "are you okay?" I said nothing. Instead, I rolled over on my side, facing the wall, and cried as quietly as possible. Eventually, I fell asleep, exhausted from being beaten up by my father. I knew this man, my other father, the menacing, violent man. Before I could mutter an answer, he slapped me hard across the face. I didn't know what time it was when Dad came into my room, picked me up out of bed, and carried me into the small study that was next to my room. He sat on the small sofa and gently sat me next to him. His face was wet with tears spilling out of him, big, wet, heavy tears. "I'm so sorry," and he started to cry, not like I cried, silently and filled with fear. No, he cried with a sense of abandon and contrition. And I knew he was sorry, but I also knew, for the first time, that there was a darkness to my father that he couldn't control. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was true.
Thank you for listening to Father and Son, a memoir by Joshua Powell.